Macintosh Folklore Radio, written by Andy Hertzfeld and Company, and read by Derek Warren. Saving Lives, August 1983. We always thought of the Macintosh as a fast computer, since its 68,000 microprocessor was effectively 10 times faster than an Apple II. But our Achilles heel was the floppy disk drive. We had very limited memory, so it was often necessary to load data from the floppy drive, where we were no faster than an Apple II. Once we had real applications running, it was clear the floppy disk was going to be a significant bottleneck. One of the things that bothered Steve Jobs the most was the time it took to boot when the Mac was first powered on. It could take a couple of minutes, or even more, to test memory, initialize the operating system, and load the Finder. One afternoon, Steve came up with an original way to motivate us to make things faster. Larry Kenyon was the engineer working on the disk driver and file system. Steve walked into his cubicle and started to exhort him. "The Macintosh boots too slowly. You've got to make it faster." Larry started to explain some of the places where he thought he could improve things, but Steve wasn't interested. He continued, "You know, I've been thinking about it. How many people are going to be using the Macintosh? A million? No, more than that. In a few years, I bet 5 million people will be booting up their Macintoshes at least once a day. Well, let's say you can shave 10 seconds off of the boot time. Multiply that by 5 million users, and that's 50 million seconds every single day. Over a year, that's probably dozens of lifetimes. So if you can make it boot 10 seconds faster, you've saved a dozen lives. That's really worth it, don't you think?" We were already motivated to make the software go as fast as possible, so I'm not sure if this pitch had much effect. But we thought it was pretty humorous, and we did manage to shave more than 10 seconds off the boot time over the next couple of months. World-Class Cities by Susan Kerr, August 1983. Landing in the Macintosh Group as a bitmap graphic designer was a lucky break for me. One of the more interesting parts of the job was designing screen fonts. This was especially enjoyable because the Macintosh was able to display proportional typefaces, leaving behind the tyranny of monospaced alphabets with their narrow M's and wide I's. The first Macintosh font was designed to be a bold system font with no jagged diagonals and was originally called Elefont. There were going to be lots of fonts, so we were looking for a set of attractive, related names. Andy Hertzfeld and I had met in high school in suburban Philadelphia, so we started naming the other fonts after stops on the Paoli local commuter train: Overbrook, Marion, Ardmore, and Rosemont. Ransom was the only font that broke this convention. It was a font of mismatched letters intended to evoke messages from kidnappers made from cutout letters. One day, Steve Jobs stopped by the software group, as he often did at the end of the day. He frowned as he looked at the font names in a menu. "What are those names?" he asked, and we explained about the Paoli local. "Well," he said, "cities are okay, but not little cities that nobody's ever heard of. They ought to be world-class cities." So that is how Chicago, formerly Elefont, New York, Geneva, London, San Francisco, the Ransom font, Toronto, and Venice, Bill Atkinson's script font, got their names. A Big Scare by Dan Cochran. On April 8th of 1983, Steve Jobs came by the Lisa offices on Bandley Drive with Jerry Brown, the former governor of California, in tow. I had just arrived with a full day of work already scheduled, but had to drop everything when Steve asked me to brief Jerry Brown on the Lisa and to give him a tour of the Apple offices. Al Mandel and I spent an hour or so with Jerry in the Lisa Sneak Room, a very well-designed multimedia executive briefing facility. We did some demonstrations and encouraged him to try some things for himself. We even took apart a Lisa to show him the hardware architecture. Jerry tried to feign interest, but his mind was off somewhere else, as it often was during his tenure as governor. After the show and tell, I took Brown on a guided tour through the Lisa facilities and visited the engineering, documentation, and marketing departments. When I had taken other famous people on walkthroughs, Apple employees usually never so much as batted an eye. We were accustomed to celebrities. After all, we were celebrities as well. However, the reaction to Jerry Brown was unlike anything I'd ever seen. People were very nervous and concerned. While Jerry was talking to an engineer, someone took me aside, looked at me straight in the eye, and pointed at Jerry with a look of anguish on his face. I had no idea what he was getting at, and I nonchalantly replied, "Yeah, that's Jerry Brown." After about 10 minutes, Jerry had completely lost interest. I walked him out of the offices, and we bid each other goodbye. As soon as I went back in the Bandley lobby, I discovered the source of the bewilderment. The Apple rumor mill was always incredibly active, and that morning, unbeknownst to me, because I'd been locked up with the former governor, the word on Bandley Drive had it that Apple was prepared to announce a new CEO that day. Jerry's arrival at the Lisa offices nearly triggered one of the biggest Wall Street panics since Black Monday. Some people were convinced that Jerry was to be named the new CEO of Apple. Looking back at that time in Apple's history, this scenario was actually very plausible. As it turns out, the Apple rumor mill was correct. Later that day, John Sculley was announced as the new CEO of Apple. But that's another story for another time.